And we are back to the reading of the Richmond Times-Dispatch for Sunday, April 21st, here on the Virginia Voice. I'm your announcer, Dennis Waldron, and now we will return to your Virginia Voice readers, Paul Vecchione and Irma Kelly.
We turn now to our commentary section, and we have this article on the front page, Doubling Down on Censorship, and this is by Michael Paul Williams. After the Hanover County School Board banned 19 books last June, Kate Lindley launched, quote, Free Road to Read, unquote, her Girl Scout Gold Award project. Lindley, who'd competed as a reading Olympian, as a Hanover student, was appalled at the censorship and determined to combat it. She coded a free-to-read app with information about the misbegotten ban and the books affected. And after the board banned more than 70 additional books in November, she set up banned book nooks at two Hanover businesses, More Donuts in Mechanicsville and We Think in Ink in Ashland. At its April 10th meeting, the Hanover Board of Supervisors honored Lindley and several other Girl Scouts from Troop 789 in Hanover, who'd earned their gold awards, the highest award granted by Girl Scouts of the USA. But like their counterparts on the county school board, the Board of Supervisors could not resist the temptation to censor. Cold Harbor Supervisor Michael Herzberg stripped Lindley's proclamation of its context by removing mention of the school board book bans that spurred her to action in the first place. And then, save absent Ashland Supervisor Faye Pritchard, it unanimously approved the redacted document, effectively distorting the story behind it. In support of a school board ban of literary classics such as, title, quote, Slaughterhouse-Five and The Handmaid's Tale, among other titles, the supervisors censored a Girl Scout. You can't make this up. Quote, honestly, at first, I just started laughing, recalled Lindley, a senior at Maggie L. Walker Governor's School, who's headed to Georgia Tech to study computer science. Quote, it's kind of hilarious for me. It's very ironic that they decided to censor my project that's meant to fight censorship, unquote. Asked in an email why he edited Lindley's proclamation, Herzberg replied, quote, Board proclamations are issued with a vote by the board. Some books that contain porn and sexually explicit content were deselected from Hanover Public Schools, and I support that action. Books with porn and sexually explicit content do not have my support for a board proclamation, unquote. Our young people are smarter than these politicians think. They can smell the stench of rank hypocrisy a country mile away. They aren't fooled by folks spouting platitudes about the Constitution while supporting politicians who forswear their oath to the document as they toss lit matchsticks at the First Amendment. They can distinguish a political exercise from an educational one. Quote, their motivations don't seem to me in any way to be noble or for the actual protection of students, unquote, Lindley said. For technology-savvy high school students on the cusp of adulthood, censoring reading materials is, quote, a pointless waste of time, unquote. In Virginia, it could be worse. We could be like Missouri or other states that have criminalized those who don't go along with this censorship agenda. a suburban St. Louis library removed an illustrated edition of the Margaret Atwood classic, The Handmaid's Tale, after Missouri passed a law subjecting librarians to fines and possible imprisonment for allowing sexually explicit materials on bookshelves, according to the Associated Press. Quote, there's a depiction of a rape scene, a handmaid being forced into a sexual act, unquote, Tom Bober, Clayton District's library coordinator, says in the AP story, quote, it's literally one panel of the graphic novel, but we felt it was in violation of the law in Missouri, unquote. The laws are designed to limit or remove legal protections that libraries have had for decades, quote, said Deborah Caldwell Stone, director of the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom, stated in the story. When you start locking up the librarians, it's only a matter of time before the mob starts making a bonfire out of thousands of books as a prelude of the horrors to come. Speaking of incarceration, it should come as no surprise that more books are banned in prisons than in schools and libraries combined. That was among the findings of Wanda Felsenhart, a graduate student at Virginia Commonwealth University's Brand Center, as she completed her award-winning entry in the Jurgen Comics Contest by VCU Libraries. The contest is named for James Branch Cabell's 1919 book, Jurgen, A Comedy of Justice, the object of an ultimately unsuccessful obscenity lawsuit by the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice. It focuses, quote, on telling stories of banned art as a way to consider the complex relationship between art and society and the long history of censorship, unquote. Disclosure given, my wife sits on the board of VCU's Cabell Library. According to Felsenhart's comic, among the banned books are, quote, Prison Ramen, Recipes and Stories from Behind Bars, unquote, the title, Dungeons and Dragons Manuals and In Florida, which leads the nation in prison book banning, Klingon Dictionaries. Klingons are a fictional race from the Star Trek series. Quote, people, no matter where they are, should have that connection to the outside world and have the ability to learn and better themselves through reading. I think reading is so fundamentally important, unquote, Felsenhart said. Of course, there are documented links between low literacy and incarceration, but just as school boards cite, quote, protecting the kids, unquote, to justify censorship, prisons point at, quote, security, unquote, as a reason for censorship, even as prison libraries aid rehabilitation efforts. Quote, I don't think reading a book is inherently violent or dangerous ever. So just the fact that people want to ban things, any type of reading, is crazy to me. Quote, again, Felsenhart said, even being able to read things you disagree with is important just to become more well-rounded and have more empathy toward people who aren't like you. In prison, not unlike in our public school districts and libraries, black authors are often targeted. Topics such as civil rights, injustice, or prison reform are red-flagged. Felsenhart's comic quotes James Baldwin saying, quote, the victim who is able to articulate the situation of the victim has ceased to be a victim. He or she has become a threat, unquote. taken from James Baldwin. Apparently, Lindley represents a threat in Hanover. Quote, I am honored that they think that my project is enough of a disruption that they feel the need to censor it in any way, she said. That is an honor to me and the work I've done, personally. But still, maybe not the best choice they could have made. To stock her banned book Nooks, she receives donations from the Amazon wish list on her free-to-read page on Instagram. Lindley plans to speak at Wednesday's Board of Supervisors meeting so that the audience, quote, can understand and appreciate my project for what it was and what it continues to be. Unquote. That's assuming the board allows her to speak freely. And this article is Doubling Down on Censorship by Michael Paul Williams. Paul?
Thank you, Emma. Next on the front page of the opinion section, Gun Violence in the City, an editorial, Systemic Economic Isolation, Not Gun-Toting Teenagers, is killing RVA, and this is by the Times-Dispatch editorial board. This is accompanied by a photo in the photo Mayor LeVar Stoney listens during a news conference on Monday as the Richmond Public School Superintendent Jason Kamers outlines the impacts of gun violence on the school system and the student body. In Richmond, deadly shootings tend to occupy the public conscience like a passing April shower. They come and go like downpours. The collective outrage over the latest homicide spree, 10 since Easter, four of whom were teenagers as of Friday afternoon, is sparking a new round of law enforcement crackdowns and renewed calls for family and community interventions. And of course, the Lock 'em Up news conference at City Hall on Monday, the morning after another 16-year-old boy was shot to death in Gilpin Court, Richmond Police Chief Rick Edwards, Richmond Public Schools Superintendent Jason Kamers, and Mayor LeVar Stoney stepped before the cameras to plead for the community's help. Stoney, himself a new father, vowed, "We will find you," before nearly breaking down. He called for parents to step up their game. We, as a community at large, are here to help. If you're running into a problem that makes it difficult for you to care for your child, to parent your family, please let us know, he said. The doors are open. Whether it's in the faith community, the nonprofit community, organizations who are in these neighborhoods, we all want to do our part. The police chief is stepping up enforcement, along with kick-starting Operation Safe Summer, more than a month early, free gun safes, youth programs, and interagency partnerships to add patrols and better police high-crime neighborhoods. An 11 p.m. teen curfew went into effect on Friday. The stopgap measures are important and necessary. The city has no choice but to find a way to stanch the bleeding. When violence erupts, public safety must become our top priority. At some point, however, we must acknowledge the hard truth. Despite all the political convulsions, no one really expects this problem to go away. Gun violence has been part of Richmond's story for at least 40 years. There are just too many guns and too much poverty concentrated in the city's most economically distressed communities, typically in and around public housing in the East End, North Side, and South Side. Generations of broken families cut off from the resources necessary to attain any semblance of financial security breed more of the same. The foundations were laid during Reconstruction and exacerbated during the Great Depressions through the 1950s, when legal segregation ended and the interstate highway system ripped through Richmond, redlining trapped black families, cutting them off from wealth building by denying them access to home ownership. What started as government-subsidized workforce housing, like Gilpin Court, to replace slums in the 1940s, became go-to public policy when the government veered construction through those same black communities a decade later. From 1952 to 1962, thousands of black families were forced into substandard replacement housing. Hence, the remaining courts, Creighton, Fairfield, Hillside, Mosby, and Whitcomb, that remained largely as they were then, incubators of extreme poverty and violence. Beginning in the late 1860s, state lawmakers in Richmond incorporated the principle of separating cities legally from surrounding counties, later codifying independent cities in the Virginia Constitution. Originally, the idea was to strengthen cities as economic centers in regions across the state, but by the mid-1950s, it was being used to cut off growth in those same cities and strengthen surrounding counties. It was no accident that lawmakers were intentionally isolating Virginia cities, says the Reverend Ben Campbell, former pastoral director of the Richmond Hill and author of Richmond's Unhealed History. From 1970 to 1978, white flight to the suburban counties exploded as Richmond's schools became fully integrated and black political leaders assumed power at City Hall. Discriminating by race was official public policy in Virginia, followed by the Civil War onward, Campbell explained in an interview last week. Rather than have your urban policy based on having strong cities, it became a way to continue segregation. After the city's annexation of 23 square miles and 47,000 mostly white residents from Chesterfield County in 1970, the General Assembly's decision to end annexations altogether was the door-slamming action of the state's segregationist leadership, Campbell said. Over the next 50 years, as the black middle class followed white families to the suburbs, Richmond's black poverty condensed and grew worse. Those with the resources to get out did. Those who couldn't were left behind, just as economic stagnation and manufacturing jobs began to disappear across the country. With limited public transit and access to employment in the bustling suburbs, the city's poverty worsened. Richmond has made measurable progress during the last decade, filling to the brim with socially conscious young people, cool restaurants, and breweries, along with budding arts and music scene that has helped rejuvenate the city's tax base. Generous historic tax credits and a real estate abatement program launched in the early 1990s has led to widespread reinvestment in previously left-for-dead neighborhoods, places like Brooklyn Park, Carver, Churchill, and Jackson Ward. The overall poverty rate has declined in the city, dropping to 19%, and extreme poverty among black residents has lessened in Richmond over the past few years. All of the tax credits led to a pattern of government-subsidized gentrification that pushed some of that poverty into surrounding counties, which have become more racially and economically diverse. But it isn't enough. Despite the recent growth, Richmond continues to have the highest concentration of extremely poor families in the metro region, and the city continues to be isolated economically. Meanwhile, the current affordable housing crisis has stunted progress. You don't change it overnight, Campbell said. You also don't solve it by pretending it's not a problem, and you certainly don't solve it by racializing the conversation. In the meantime, all that poverty will keep producing violence that can't be remedied with curfews, gun safes, or bigger jails. During last week's news conference, a visibly frustrated Camras, the Richmond Public Schools superintendent, issued a clarion call. Since 2019, 169 juveniles in the city of Richmond have been shot. Nearly all of them were Richmond Public School students. Our community, our schools, they're hurting, and they should be focused on the SOLs which we are giving in 2 weeks And instead of many of them this morning and last week and tomorrow are holding grief sessions, he said at City Hall, because that's what we do. We will always stand in the gap for our kids, but we have to change this. Until our political leaders and the broader metropolitan community acknowledge, prioritize, and commit to addressing the root cause, crippling systemic economic isolation and poverty, gun violence will ebb and flow like it always has. Again, that story was an editorial from the Richmond Times-Dispatch Board of Editors, and it is systemic economic isolation, not gun-toting teenagers, is killing RVA. Irma?
Also on the front page of commentary, we have this editorial article, The Lessons of Passover. Compassion must cross all borders. And this article is by Michael Knopf. It notes that Rabbi Michael Knopf serves at Temple Beth El in Richmond and is a member of Teruah, a rabbinic human rights organization. Noting further, the views expressed in this article are solely his own. Each year, Passover brings with it fond memories of attending the Seder at my grandparents' home in Atlanta. Like many Jewish Americans of his generation, my grandfather was both a child of immigrants and a veteran. His parents came to the U.S. from Eastern Europe early in the 20th century. In 1944, he fought in the Battle of Hürjen Forest, where he was shot in the head by German snipers. Thankfully, he survived, recovered, and ultimately received a Purple Heart. Those complementary experiences, benefiting from the blessings of American democracy and risking his life defending it, made Grandpa a lifelong champion of freedom and equality for all. That's why for him, Passover wasn't just any other holiday. Rather, it represented the essence of what is meant to be Jewish. As he led our Seder, he would emphasize that we as Jews annually commemorate the ancient Exodus not simply to celebrate our own freedom, but also to recommit ourselves to the work of liberating all who are oppressed. Last month, I carried Grandpa's memory with me to our nation's capital. I was part of a group of rabbis from across the country convened by American Jewish World Service, AJWS, a grant-making organization inspired by Jewish values that champions human rights around the globe. Our delegation gathered in Washington, D.C., to speak with congressional leaders and administration officials, in part about the collapse of civil society in Haiti. In recent months, the island nation has descended into violent chaos. Millions of innocents are caught in the crossfire of gangs and cartels, desperately yearning for a free and democratic future. I was honored to share Grandpa's story and his message in the corridors of American power. Of course, it was not lost on us or on the leaders with whom we met that as we discussed these issues, another crisis was raging in the Middle East. As rabbis, this subject certainly weighed on our hearts. Yet, while we believe it important for Jewish Americans to discuss the Israeli-Palestinian conflict with our elected officials, we were animated by a conviction that we, as Jews, are called to think bigger and to hold more expansive concerns than those that directly impact our own community. Judaism is ultimately about more than just the Jewish people and Jewish affairs, narrowly defined. To put it another way, a humanitarian disaster in Haiti and the oppression of marginalized peoples everywhere are also Jewish concerns, for none are free unless all are free. Consider this. The Seder is divided into two parts, the pre-dinner portion, which focuses on the story of the ancient exodus from Egypt, and the post-dinner portion, which, by contrast, is decidedly forward-facing. We open the door for Elijah the prophet and pray for him to arrive, ushering in the messianic era. And at the Seder's conclusion, we exclaim, quote, "Next year in Jerusalem," unquote, affirming our hope that the coming year will herald a repaired and perfected world. And this is the larger portion of the editorial, The Lessons of Passover, Compassion Must Cross All Borders, by Michael Knopf.